From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory has conceded in his bid for re-election after calling for recounts and alleging voter fraud that was never found. On the national level in politics, Donald Trump is expanding his dance card in his search for a Secretary of State and confirming that he'll nominate Dr. Ben Carson to be the next Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, even though Carson has no experience in that area. It's another case of Trump picking or considering a former rival for his cabinet. Here Trump is talking about Carson last year.
So he's a pathological, damaged temper, a problem.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Ron, Trump also compared Carson's temper to the personality of a child molester and that both were incurable. And just last month, one of Carson's closest aides quoted him as saying Carson didn't think he was qualified to run a federal agency. What changed here?
The political calculation would be what you'd have to look at, just like it changed last spring when Ben Carson went from being a presidential rival of Donald Trump to actually being something of an ally who had Donald Trump's flank, actually helped him against Ted Cruz. So they've all long since buried that hatchet, and now Ben Carson's on the team and has been for a while. And there was always the prospect of a cabinet job for him. He said he didn't really want to be a federal bureaucrat, but that's not really what a secretary of a department does. They do have responsibility for running the department, but others do that. And he will be a political figure representing what Donald Trump sees as the way out of poverty for African-Americans and other poor Americans.
Well, you say African-Americans, and he does add diversity to a cabinet. There was criticism that Trump was picking a lot of white men for these jobs. But what are the questions that are going to be asked, and will Ben Carson have answers?
The kind of questions that will probably be asked will be programmatic ones, which he will refer to others. He will probably have no problem being confirmed, and he will represent this aspirational story that was really his strongest suit as a candidate for president, rising himself from a poverty background in Detroit with a single mother, and he has accomplished so much, he's going to point to himself as a paragon and as a map for the way to get out.
Talk a little bit about another rival and another search, this time for a Secretary of State. We know that Donald Trump had been considering Mitt Romney, but has his campaigns announced they've widened their search. Your thoughts on this? He's not only widened their search, but including another Mormon from the state of Utah. Your thoughts on why Mitt Romney is staying in this?
John Huntsman is the gentleman you're referring to, the former Utah governor, also former ambassador to China, a very interesting background for someone to move into the Secretary of State's position if we are going to be going into a confrontational mode with China, as other things the president-elect has been doing this weekend might indicate. So John Huntsman and Mitt Romney are actually, I think, they're distant cousins. Many Mormons are related, and they both been prominent figures in politics, but they're not really pals. So this may be one more way of just turning the heat up a little bit on Mitt Romney. We've also got four or five other candidates. The president-elect has also talked about Rex Tillerson from Exxon Corporation as a potential Secretary of State. So, yes, they're still widening the gyre on this.
Yeah. Quick, your thoughts on the scary moment yesterday in Washington. A man armed with an assault rifle goes into a pizza restaurant to investigate the lie on the internet that is related to Hillary Clinton and that restaurant and a potential sex ring. Absolutely debunked. But the son of Trump's pick for security advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, is one of the ones fanning the flames of this lie. What happens to that as the Trump administration goes forward?
There don't seem to be too many police in cyberspace, but fortunately there are police in Washington, D.C. This particular pizza parlor is two blocks from my home, so it's the closest pizza to my front door. It was quite a disruptive day yesterday with helicopters overhead and many, many police vehicles. I suspect we're going to see incidents of this kind as long as people find it possible to go after vulnerable folks on the internet and expose them to vicious misinformation and conspiracy theories.
But politically, is there a moment where people say to the security advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, stop your son from spreading this?
Perhaps that would be one of the things that would be strongly suggested to the security advisor and that he might strongly suggest to his son. But here again, controlling people in internet space is an extraordinarily difficult problem, as we all know.
Yeah. The other big news, North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory conceding the election to the Democrat, the AG Roy Cooper. McCrory alleged dead people and felons had voted, that black voter outreach groups had conducted voter fraud schemes. Just a few seconds, but pretty ugly ending there.
Yeah, it's probably difficult for Pat McCrory, seeing that Donald Trump carried his state, to think that he could not be reelected. But there were apparently enough people still upset about the transgender bathrooms controversy from last year to differentiate between McCrory and Donald Trump. And after all, he said he thought he could find 10,000 instances of voter fraud, and they don't seem to have turned up any, or at least not any substantial number. The margin between the two candidates just kept getting wider, and he finally gave up.
NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
At least 36 people are confirmed dead so far in that devastating Oakland warehouse fire. Oakland Fire Battalion Chief Melinda Drayton said today that investigators believe they found the area of the building where the fire started, but they don't yet know what caused it.
We are no closer to finding a cause, and we absolutely believe that the number of fire fatalities will increase.
Joining us now via Skype is Jim Pauley, who's president of the National Fire Protection Association. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And we know that there is no word yet on the cause of the fire, but we have heard that the warehouse didn't have a sprinkler system, that there was a staircase built out of wooden pallets, and that there were only two exits in that building. So based on what we know at this point, what do you think were some of the factors that contributed to such a high death toll?
Well, I think the key, and really all of the things that you mentioned, really gets back to complacency that we all have as the public around fire. We've done a great job over the decades at reducing the instance of fire, and that's made people more complacent as, well, I'll never have a fire. It will never happen to me. And so the actions that necessarily get taken don't reflect the fact that when a fire does happen, you need to have appropriate exits. You need to have appropriate fire systems that are in place. And so that issue of complacency is one that we at NFPA are talking a lot about. And how do we continue to educate people around the risks associated with fire and making sure they take the appropriate actions?
But was the issue, do you think, in this case more about a building that was not in any shape to be occupied, that wasn't up to the codes it should have been up to, or the fact that it was being used in this way where there were so many people in it at one time?
Well, I think that's a situation where it's both. Whether it was people that were staying and living there, whether it was being used as a nightclub, whether it was simply being used as a warehouse, I think all of those factors are going to have to be sorted out. And any of those occupancies that it might have been, if you were doing that building specifically for that occupancy, there are sets of rules and regulations and fire codes that go into place to say these are the things that you need, such as appropriate exits, such as appropriate stairways. So I think many of those things will be coming to light as they continue to investigate.
If you were to tour major cities around this country, would you find a lot of buildings that are in such bad shape as that one? Would you find many other fire hazards around the country?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think the fire services in many cities are having to deal with these new type of environments that are coming up. And in many cases, you have things that are being changed in a building and nobody knows except the occupants or the people that are in that building. The government officials don't know. The enforcement community doesn't know. The fire department doesn't know. And how often that's occurring, one of the concerns can certainly be as older spaces in cities are being used for different uses, that may actually be climbing in some of these cities.
So what can people do now after such a terrible fire in Oakland with so many dead? What should people do as they go into buildings, you know, on a day-to-day basis to make sure that they can get out if they need to or that they're in a safe place?
Well, that's a great question. And I think in some cases, it's common sense. And in some cases, it's kind of changing that paradigm a little bit from the complacency I talked about. So before you enter a building, you take a good look at the building. Does it appear to be in a condition that would make you feel safe? Do the exits open outward to allow people to get out? Is material being stored all around the building that would make it more difficult to navigate through the building or could potentially be a fire hazard? I mean, things that you would not typically think about, we really need to get people to just take a few moments and think about those elements. You know, what's your communication plan? Identify somebody that you would contact in the case of an emergency or if you're separated from your family or friends. Plan a meeting place that if something that you were attending a function, where would you go to where people would know you would be if something happened in that particular venue? And then there's the items when you get in the building. One of the first things that I do and I recommend everybody does is when you walk into a building you're unfamiliar with, locate the exits. It just takes a few moments to look and see where are those exits? Are there clear paths to those exits? And just in general in the building, do you feel safe? Does this building appear to be really overcrowded? Are candles burning in the building that you think might be a fire hazard? Applying some of those elements can really make a difference in how you would react if something happened.
That's Jim Pauley, the president of the National Fire Protection Association. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's here and now. Ryan Speedo Green, Speedo because his dad loved, well, Speedos, is the young African-American baritone bass currently basking in applause and rave reviews in the role of Kalina in Puccini's La Boheme at New York's famed Metropolitan Opera. The New York Times said Speedo was the showstopper.
Hello.
This is Ryan.
Hi, I'm Speedo.
Boy, that voice.
Hey, I'm Tanya.
Nice to meet you. Recently, we met up at the Met with Speedo and journalist Daniel Bergner, whose book Singing for Your Life tells the story of Speedo's improbable journey to this place. His parents could be violent. After his dad left, his mom became more abusive. At 12, Speedo lashed back, pulling a knife on her, which landed him in solitary confinement in a brutal juvenile detention center. But then a combination of teachers steered him to the Governor's Magnet School for the Arts in Roanoke, Virginia, which made a fateful field trip here to the Met. Much later, he was accepted into the Met's elite Lindemann Young Artist Development Program. We learn more as we walk this beautiful opera house, starting next to a glass case of ball gowns. Must be costumes from the past.
La Traviata.
La Traviata.
Yeah.
Okay, so have you gotten used to this?
Gotten used to it? Well, you know, there's still some hallways that I walk into that I've never walked into before.
People, it's Byzantine.
Yeah, exactly. So it's always incredibly exciting to come back, but it still has the same feeling of when I first came here when I was 15.
Well, let's talk about that. We can walk down this red velvet. I feel like I'm inside a jewelry box here. Talk about when you first came.
Yes, so at the age of 15, I went on a school field trip with my Magnet School for the Arts, and this is my first time seeing an opera. And the opera was Carmen. The lead character was played by an African-American mezzo-soprano by the name of Denise Graves. And for a 15-year-old me, who thought opera was something only a white person could do, was something that I never thought I would see a person who looks like me, who has the same color as me, on stage doing. It made it tangible. And she was amazing. She made me feel every emotion I could feel. And afterwards, I got to meet her.
She hugged you.
So it's almost like it should be, like it's almost, for me, movie-like. I walked outside and I was with my chorus teacher, Robert Brown. And I told him, you know, Mr. Brown, I want to sing at the Met. That's what I want to do. And it was the first real dream that I ever had. And less than 9 years, 9 years later, I was singing at the Metropolitan Opera.
We walked past practice rooms and corridors piled high with costumes and sheet music, the same corridors Speedo paced those 9 years later when, as a 24-year-old, after studying in college, he competed in the Metropolitan Opera's National Council auditions, a portal to professional success. Here he is in the finals. Speedo was one of the winners, and there that day, journalist Daniel Bergner. What did you see?
I saw a radiant human being. I was slowly hearing a story about transformation, about the power of will.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Speedo. Go back to when you were a kid. Terrible childhood that I understand you're not always comfortable talking about, but
Lots of violence. You've said that when you see the documents that Daniel got after you were taken away to a facility after you drew a knife on your mom, you don't even recognize that person.
No, I didn't. The person that I am today is a completely different person than I was back then. I think one of the first things I did when I got out of the detention center was to put everything behind me. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't have been able to move forward and take up the task that I did after I got out.
There were a couple of very inspiring teachers who refused to give up on Speedo. And
Mr. and Mrs. Hughes come to mind.
And Mr. Brown. And then just a tremendous amount of determination.
Well, talk about along the way, though. Let's talk about the sound, because a lot of people think, oh, and it was discovered when he was 12 that he opened his mouth and out came angels. It didn't happen that way.
No.
It's funny. I went back to the School for the Arts where he was almost thrown out after his first year because he had no ability to read music and no particular promise. And I said, what's the truth? And the director of the vocal program said, listen, he could not sing. You were not hearing then what anything like what you're hearing now.
Ultimately, the voice that we hear now started to appear, but when it first did, Speedo had to learn how to use it, train like an athlete, like a surgeon. And he was surrounded by other singers who'd been singing and training their whole young lives in multiple languages.
Despite preconceptions, I did not grow up singing in the church, nor was I a prodigy by any means. I dreamed of being an opera singer before I had the tools.
Well, and it's just no guarantee. All these many coaches are hoping. I'm reading one coach say, you were born with a trombone and you had to work to get a little more of a trumpet. You had to figure out how to sing 30 pitches on approximately 20 vowels, 600 combinations.
Yeah. That alone, you know, is daunting for a person who went a lot on gut. It took almost a year with maybe two or three voice lessons a week just to be able to implement it.
You know, the fact that Americans, we get lazy in our speech, so we say absolutely, suh. It's really absolutely. But when you're singing in Italian and you do that same thing in Italian, the entire audience might cringe.
And not only will the audience cringe, but my colleagues on stage or maybe the conductor, who is most likely Italian, will give me a look. Luckily, I know enough to be able to get by these rehearsals,
yeah,
but it's definitely a growing experience.
Well, but when this is happening, luckily you're you, because you made a decision to admit that you hadn't been studying since you were 13. And so there's these poignant moments, people working so hard with you, and someone says, well, make it more melancholy. And you say, I don't know what that is.
You know, I made a conscious decision to not let any of this go to waste. Maybe someone might look at me weird to be like, oh, how could you not know what melancholy means? But for me, like, the moment that they tell me, I'll know. Whatever. Yeah, I'm sorry. I literally can't think.
You're done.
Yeah.
On this day, Speedo is tired. But as we mentioned, he also has trouble at times talking about the traumatic moments in his past. After he left for an audition, we asked Daniel about that.
One of the realizations I had was that people in my world assume that digging deep into the past is going to liberate us and make us better people, more functional people. That was not Speedo's assumption. He really needed, when he got out of that facility, and remember, he was taken there not only in handcuffs, but in leg shackles. This was a really violent moment in his life. And when he got out of there, his impulse was close the door on the past. And in lots of ways, of course, he was right.
Did you ever think, wow, what if he doesn't have an opera voice?
I think this is a key point. There was so much doubt.
And then when he did develop the voice, how heartbreaking to hear. He's now singing the finest opera arias, and everyone, you know, at fundraising events wants him to sing Old Man River.
Right. So from the very beginning, Speedo has faced the challenges of race from all directions. Of course, his black friends in high school taunted him for singing white music. At the same time, ever since he started singing classically, white audience members have come up afterward and said, oh, you should really just sing like Paul Robeson and sing Old Man River. And this haunts him to this day. Omen River is a wonderful song, but it is sung by a black character who's all but a slave in the Jim Crow South and who longs for death as the only release from the chains that he symbolically wears. And this is the great thing about Speedo's story to me, is it's all about trying to break out of boxes. The box that he was put in as a 12-year-old when he was locked up in an institution, and the box that race puts him in terms of identity. All his life, he's been trying to expand the boundaries of his identity. And the request to sing Old Man River, even though it's beautiful, and believe me, he can sing it beautifully, are an attempt in the end to put him back inside a box.
As we said goodbye, Speedo told us about his recent visit to one of those boxes.
I was able to go back to the detention facility. And once I got over the trauma of seeing my cell and the solitary confinement where I spent a lot of time in, I was able to sing and speak to the kids. And I told them that I had once been where they were sitting. And they couldn't believe it. And one of the kids asked me, like, so that means I could go to college? That was huge. And, you know, there were some kids there who tried to spit on me as I was singing. Even that, I tried to connect with them, tried to sing to them as if you were part of the aria. And one of the kids said he was a rapper. And, you know, he had this sort of overly tough persona. Reminded me of myself when I was his age. And I realized that a lot of the reasons why I was so angry and I was so had so many eruptions and I was so violent was because maybe I couldn't accept kindness from others, and maybe I just didn't like the person that I was. It was such an honor for them to open up to me.
Cast of La Boheme, including Ryan Speedo Green, at the Metropolitan Opera in New York for just a few more days. Then Speedo heads to Austria for featured roles with the Vienna State Opera, a long way from a juvenile detention facility. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
President-elect Donald Trump says there will soon be a tax of 35% for companies that move overseas and try to sell goods back across the border. He made the comments in a tweet storm yesterday, just days after announcing his involvement in that deal to keep 800 jobs at the Carrier air conditioning plant in Indiana. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She joins us from New York. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And how difficult would it be for Trump to actually implement such a tax of 35% for companies that leave the U.S. and try to sell their goods back?
Well, it would actually be kind of tough. And obviously, there could be some congressional approval that is needed. But there are also some things that he can do with the help of the Commerce Secretary, now named Wilbur Ross, that can actually make this a quicker outcome than you might expect. In fact, a lot of economists are somewhat concerned because they believe that trade is one area where the president has quite a big berth when it comes to making decisions and enacting policy.
Has the U.S. ever done anything like this in the past?
I hate to go back to the 30s to do this, but we will. Of course, you all remember in high school the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in 1930, which prompted a global trade war. Now, this is actually kind of interesting because when you look at the time prior to that, there was a lot of globalization in the early 20th century, right? And we had the modern industrial era. And what happened? The share of income that went to the richest 1% rose steadily, and then you had popular resentment, and then the country turns inward, and Congress passes this sweeping act, which actually began a huge trade war, and it was not very good. In fact, many economists believe that it exacerbated the global depression.
Would a tax, though, be enough to deal with the underlying economic issues that American companies move overseas because production costs are so much cheaper.
Well, I mean, it could partially do that. But remember, you know, with all of these trade deals or in the way we've even looked at NAFTA and certainly the way President-elect Trump has described it, there are winners and there are losers, right? So sure, are there certain domestic producers that might actually benefit from this? Yes. However, there are a lot of American businesses that would be harmed by the action. And frankly, there would likely be some retaliation by other countries like China. So think about this. You've got a manufacturing facility here in the U.S., but you have certain components that come in from overseas. That could make your product more expensive. If you're an exporter, clearly that would be bad. If you are a big multinational, a 3M, a McDonald's, a Colgate, this could be very bad news for you. And if those big kinds of companies are under pressure, they may cut jobs in far larger numbers than these domestic producers are either adding or retaining jobs.
Just a few seconds left, Jill, but on the carrier deal that we mentioned, even some Trump supporters have attacked it. Sarah Palin called it crony capitalism.
Well, look, this is certainly antithetical to classic conservative economic theory. But that said, I think that most people are saying this was a pretty good PR move. Just be clear, when we have trade wars, one last effect, the prices of everything tend to rise. And inflation is something that would infect millions as opposed to the hundreds of jobs that could be saved in any of these single actions.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Take care.
After Donald Trump nominated retired Marine General James Mattis to be his Secretary of Defense, we heard on this program from retired Army General Tom Hill, who expressed concerns about a military figure in charge of the Pentagon. A lot of people feel that way. There's a law banning military leaders from being defense secretary unless they've been out of uniform for 7 years. That law would have to be waived for Mattis, and it's only been waived once before for General George Marshall after World War II. So it's interesting that Thomas Ricks, a respected but often highly critical voice in military matters, says waive that law again. Ricks is author of The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. And Tom, you wrote in the New York Times over the weekend you'd normally be opposed to a veteran instead of a civilian in charge of the Pentagon. So remind us why.
This is a country built on the notion of civilian control of the military, in which generals ultimately answer to a civilian president. Yes, we've had some presidents as generals in the past. Eisenhower is really the only one in the 20th century, and he ran partly to keep another general, MacArthur, from being president. So it has been seen as an aberration, especially in modern America, to have a general at the top. Having a general at the Pentagon running it worries Congress, worries other people that you'll have someone who understands the military better than he understands politics or the American people.
Yeah. So make your case now, as you do, for General Mattis running the Pentagon.
Normally, I'd be totally against it, even though I think Mattis is a admirable, well-informed, and disciplined man. But these are not normal times. We are facing the prospect of a president who is a profoundly ignorant, impulsive man. I think Trump will be dangerous as president. So the more constraints on him that we have, the better.
Well, I'm going to jump in. Obviously, you have strong feelings about President-elect Donald Trump. So you've made it clear this is not because you are supporting him in his pick. You're supporting his pick. But let's go further. General Mattis has been called Mad Dog Mattis. He fought in the vicious Battle of Fallujah, the bloodiest battle of the Iraq War for Marines. You quote one of his sayings, "Be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everyone you meet." People might have a hard time understanding how this would be the person to temper someone you see as needing tempering, Donald Trump.
He is a good Marine. He was a good leader in combat, really beloved by the rank and file Marines. I think the mad dog thing, I don't know where that came from. I've never heard a Marine refer to General Mattis as mad dog. His own call sign in combat was chaos. And it was chaos because that's what he thought you wanted to impose on the enemy. It was also, he taught his subordinate officers to learn to thrive on chaos, to embrace it, and to find victory in the midst of chaos. It's a small word, a big concept, and it reflects Mattis' intense knowledge of war, of philosophy, This is a guy who's extraordinarily well-read, very thoughtful guy, and quite disciplined. Also, having been in combat tends to make a person less interested in going to war, not more.
So you say General Mattis isn't another George Patton, a comparison Donald Trump continually makes, comparing Mattis to Patton. You say that's not true.
I think the only thing Donald Trump knows about Patton or MacArthur is what he saw in the movies. I actually think that George C. Scott's portrayal of Patton in that movie was pretty accurate, except that, of course, the real George Patton had a kind of high, squeaky voice, not a masterly, bold voice like the actor did. But also, General Mattis is like Patton really in only one way, in being a very good combat leader. He's unlike Patton in many other ways. He never slapped soldiers who had PTSD, as Patton did during World War II. He never walked around swearing like a sailor to show off, as Patton did continually, even in front of women and children. And he was seen as fit for top command. In World War II, they sort of kept Patton in a box and used him to attack, but they would never give him top command.
Yeah. So you see General Mattis as somebody who could maybe temper what you see as Donald Trump's gut impulses. But you also say he might be a useful balance to retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who will be Trump's national security advisor. How so?
Yeah, Flynn worries me. Flynn, who was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, is a career military intelligence officer. He seems to be very close to President-elect Trump. He spoke at the Republican convention, and I thought in a rather unseemly way, joined in the locker-up chant at the convention. And so I see hope that Mattis might provide a counterweight, not just to Trump, but also to General Flynn as national security advisor.
When General Mattis was known as being more hawkish than the Obama administration on Iran, for instance, and the Iran nuclear deal. Do you worry about that?
I don't really. The job of the commander of Central Command, the U.S. military headquarters for the Middle East, is to plan for war with Iran. That's job one out there. Mattis is very fond of always asking the question, what next? What then? And I think the people in the Obama administration, particularly Tom Donilon, Obama's national security advisor, lost patience with that. And that's one reason he was pushed out of his job early at Central Command.
That's military expert Tom Ricks. His book is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. He also writes a blog for Foreign Policy magazine. Tom, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Staying with Donald Trump, he took to Twitter yesterday for an 8-tweet rant about China. Here's a portion. Did China ask us if it was okay to devalue their currency? I don't think so. He also complained about a Saturday Night Live skit in which Alec Baldwin portrayed him retweeting the thoughts of 16-year-olds during intelligence briefings, leaving Kate McKinnon as aide Kellyanne Conway to explain why.
Okay, see, there is a reason, actually, that Donald tweets so much. He does it to distract the media from his business conflicts and all the very scary people in his cabinet.
Oh, that does make sense.
Very clever, sir.
Actually, that's not why I do it. I do it because my brain is bad.
Trump tweeted out, totally biased, not funny, and the Baldwin impersonation just can't get any worse. Sad. Well, that provoked a stream of blistering, occasionally expletive-laden tweets from a trans woman and activist in St. Louis. Danielle Moscato started with, "You are the president-elect. Pick your blank battles, man. You are embarrassing yourself." Her tweets have now been retweeted and favorited thousands of times. Danielle joins us on Skype. And Danielle, this was just a Trump comment about a skit. His supporters say harmless. Why did it unleash this in you?
Well, I don't begrudge the president-elect of taking a break from his job to watch SNL. But when I hear that, you know, he's skipping intelligence briefings and that he doesn't really want to move into the White House, this sends a message to me, or I would say shouts it, that Donald Trump has no passion for this job and wishes he had lost, and that he doesn't understand the magnitude of what his role is now as the president-elect of the United States.
Why don't you read for us a couple other tweets about Baldwin's impression being sad?
I said, Baldwin's impression isn't sad. You know what's sad? In 7 weeks, you'll be responsible for 330 million lives, and you can't think of anything better to do than tweet about a comedy show. You know that actual lives are at stake, right? You're pathetic. And it goes on and on for 30 tweets. But
well, yeah, it does go on. To talk about him personally, you know what the real secret is? I'm disgusted by you, but you're disgusted by you too. Is this a good thing for democracy or a corroding thing?
I think this is an excellent thing for a democracy, and especially for people in power who don't seem to understand that they have an incredible responsibility to people. And I want to say that that wasn't a personal attack. That was a literal, specific thing that I was saying. Donald Trump lost this election. He won the Electoral College, but Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. And I think it's extraordinarily important that we never let him forget that he does not have popular support. And as activists and as just citizens of this country, it is necessary that we stand up to this and declare that this is not normal.
Look, have you heard from Trump?
I have not. He hasn't blocked me. I'm still following him. But he did make it so that if you go to that tweet, it won't show my thread anymore, which I thought was interesting.
It'll go. You can see it at yours. But do you worry? We mentioned you're a trans woman, an activist on many levels. You've already indicated you're worried about all Americans' lives under a President Trump, but you worry about yourself now. This Twitter sphere can get vicious.
Yes, it can. And I think the interesting thing to me is that the overwhelming, easily 99.9% of the responses that I've gotten are extremely positive and supportive. And most of the responses I've get were, wow, this is exactly what I was thinking, and I'm so glad you said it.
Daniel Moscato, again, an activist whose tweets to Donald Trump went viral this weekend. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Jurors deciding the fate of a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black man resumed deliberations today in South Carolina. The case against the former North Charleston officer Michael Slager appeared to be headed toward a mistrial on Friday when the jury told the judge it could not reach a unanimous decision. Slager is accused of killing Walter Scott as he ran away from the officer during a 2015 traffic stop. The shooting was captured on a cell phone video, and on Friday, a single juror said he could not convict the officer. But the jury agreed to resume their deliberations today, and we will keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, a spate of high-profile police shootings in the past few years has drawn attention to the way officers respond to people with mental illness. Until recently, that response was arrest first, ask questions later. But more police departments around the country are rethinking the way they handle these situations. Kristen Espeland-Gourlay from Rhode Island Public Radio reports on a new police training program in that state.
In a classroom at the Municipal Police Training Academy in East Greenwich, Rhode Island, retired police captain Joe Coffey facilitates a class on mental health first aid. Coffey tells the rows of recruits in blue uniforms he understands most of them signed up as officers because they wanted to help people. 7 to 15% of the calls they go on, Coffey says, will involve someone who needs help getting through a mental health crisis.
You get a really good sense of what that help may be, how to identify mental illnesses or people in crisis, how to understand it, and most importantly, how you can help.
No use of force, no one gets hurt, no one puts their hands on anyone, and the person gets in the ambulance and goes to treatment, and it's not further traumatizing to them.
Tricia Brower co-facilitates the class. She works for Gateway Health Services in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, responding to mental health emergencies in hospitals and in partnership with the police. Brower reminds recruits they've learned CPR and other physical first aid. She says mental health first aid is similar and just as critical. That's because someone in crisis might not behave the way officers expect. And knowing how to respond can mean the difference between life and death, between making an arrest or helping the person get into treatment.
Folks experiencing acute mental health issues aren't very good at following your directions. And we're going to go over some specific scenarios with you later, but that can be misperceived, and you might think that you need to kind of act differently because they're not responding to you in a way that...
Brower and Coffey are teaching the new recruits how to respond to crisis situations, anything from someone having a psychotic break to a person threatening suicide. The main idea is to listen, de-escalate the crisis, and be a conduit to help. Once officers complete this kind of training, situations that might once have escalated can turn out completely differently. Take what happened to Megan LeBeau. She works for the National Alliance for Mental Illness chapter in Rhode Island as an administrative assistant. She also has her own debilitating mental illnesses.
So I have bipolar disorder with anxiety and PTSD, And for a while, I had agoraphobia. So I hadn't left my house for about 2 years. And with the bipolar, I have psychosis. So I sometimes hear things or I see things or get very paranoid.
A few years ago, LeBeau had a psychotic episode. She hadn't slept in weeks. She'd taken tons of tranquilizers.
I called the suicide hotline because I got scared. I couldn't remember how many pills I had taken, and I thought, I want to live. I want to sleep, but I want to live. Maybe somebody can help me. And they had said, okay, well, we don't know how many you've taken, so we need to call the police and do a wellness check.
When the police arrived, they found her in the bedroom.
So there was a bottle of Klonopin, there was a bottle of Xanax, there was a butcher knife, and I had marijuana all around my bed. And they saw it all.
Spotting a butcher knife and drugs, another cop might have gotten out the handcuffs. But this officer simply asked LeBeau how she was. He said he'd take her to the hospital. He let her get dressed, smoke a cigarette. He'd been trained in crisis intervention.
He treated you like a human being.
Exactly, he did. And I think even better than a lot of people would treat somebody who was going through a psychotic break.
The hospital admitted LeBeau.
The next day, the police officer came back and checked on me to see how I was doing, to see if I slept.
She never forgot him. As of this year, mental health first aid is required training for all new police recruits in Rhode Island. It's one of the first states to embrace such a requirement. And more police departments around the country are embedding mental health clinicians directly on their forces. If it works, it could help divert more people from an overburdened criminal justice system and into treatment. For Here and Now, I'm Kristen Espeland-Gourlay.
And Kristen's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.